Yeah.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Barrett, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is May 29th, 2004. I have a home group, which is the Midtown group down in, where the heck are we now? I guess Bethesda, Maryland. We've moved around a little bit over the years, but, you know, we meet actually tonight at 7:30. And celebration speakers meeting. It's been my home group, basically my entire sobriety. And I have a sponsor, and I sponsor Men and Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor knows he's my sponsor. Talked to him on my way up here, or down here, I should say. And glad to be here. Glad to be sober. It's a pleasure. Thank you for asking me to come out. I don't always feel that way when I'm asked to speak somewhere. But, you know, it's kind of what has been shown to me. It's just like automatic. Like, if I don't have anything else going on, like, I'm there unless I'm, like, you know, laid out sick or some sort of an emergency. So thanks for having me. And, you know, my job is to basically just tell you guys, you know, what it was like for me before I got here, what happened, what got me here, and what's happened since I've been here. And I have a lot of time, so... figure out how this goes. You know, I'll talk as long as I'm supposed to. So, it's long, you know. But, you know, throughout my sobriety, there's been a lot of things that happened. So there's a lot to talk about. It's just a matter of what God sees fit to come out of my mouth tonight. So, you know, one benefit of Alcoholics Anonymous I kind of got tonight on my way up here was I was driving and just got a new car this week. And it's a little bit, it's in better condition than my car prior to. And so it just doesn't take much to kind of have a heavy foot. And on 29, got pulled over, right? And I hear that's like the infamous thing. And my buddy who I met, who, you know, we got kind of basically got sober together, had a lot of run-ins on that same road and just started flashing through my mind. And I get pulled over. And I was going. I saw what I was going when I saw him. And I slowed down. But I was like, I don't want to be too obvious. And, luckily I was dressed like this, and this is the point of the story. I was dressed like this and have been taught to kind of be respectful, you know, when I have run-ins with the law, which was not always the case. And, you know, the guy, and also, like, just got this car. I haven't even, like, put everything, like, my insurance papers, like, not even in the car. I realized that. I was like, oh, man, like, I'm just, big problem. And, have just like my record with police and, you know, like, I guess win loss is like very heavily in their favor. You know, look at that way. And typically either I'm leaving with them in their car or they're giving me a piece of paper. It's going to cost me a lot of money. And actually neither happened. Luckily, like very, very luckily. And, you know, he saw me and he was like, oh, it looks like you're on your way to someplace nice. And I was like, oh, I'm meeting a friend for dinner. And I couldn't remember the name. I was a little frazzled. And I said, oh, pig and steak, popped it up on my GPS. He's like, oh, yeah. And you know, he ran my, you know, and luckily I haven't been reckless as of recent, and my license is clean, and, you know, he let me off the hook. But I'm not going to take my chances going home because I'd hate to run into the same guy or somebody who's not in the same kind of mood. So, you know, I'm glad AA showed me how to kind of show up and suit up and show up, you know, because it's like nobody even has to ask me. Like, I just know when I go to speak somewhere, I'm in front of people, like my sponsor does it, and, you know, guys before him, you know, they put on a jacket and tie, and it's not my favorite attire, but, it, you know, it is what it is, and, you know, makes me kind of look like I've learned something here, I guess. So, so I guess I'll start off with, you know, what things were like before. So I grew up, you know, good old Yankee boy from up north. I'm from Jersey, and you know, born and raised there. Lived there till I was 13. Parents split up when I was young. Nothing to do with my alcoholism, really. I do have a slight belief, and, you know, some people may agree or disagree. I don't think it necessarily has to run in people's families, but it's definitely a trait amongst both sides of my family. Either you are, you know, knock down, drag out type drunk, addict, whatever, or, you know, or you got religion. And my parents kind of fell into the category of, you know, the drinker side. And So they split up when I was pretty young as a result of my dad's drinking. And, you know, and he remained to be kind of a pretty important part of my life. And even though he wasn't, like, right there, he made sure things happened that needed to happen, you know. Got what was needed, you know. Definitely nothing, not a ton of extras, but got what was needed. And my mom did the best she could. But something happened to her in that time frame, and I don't exactly know what happened, but she started, you know, she really took off on her drinking and stuff, and I'm not going to get too much into that, but I had plenty of examples of, like, what drinking could do potentially, you know, to people's families and things like that. You know, I got I currently actually have an uncle who's, like, wandering down in Augusta, Georgia. My mom got a call the other night, and he's not doing well, you know. Got some money the other week, a nice sum of money, you know, something that probably would carry most people for a little while, and he burned right through it, like, in the matter of, like, a week, you know, and now he's reaching out for help, potentially, and so just kind of like, and, when I look at something like that, you know, I think about, like, how blessed I am to have the life that I have today, and have been willing to kind of take the opportunity Alcoholics has given me, and actually I haven't done much other than kind of, like, show up and not, like, fight the what's been kind of laid out in front of me. And I'm really grateful for that, 'cause that's really hard for a lot of people, you know. I have a guy that I was working with recently who, you know, went back out, went drinking last weekend after about 6 months of being sober, you know, or being dry, I guess, whatever you want to call it. But definitely was missing some pieces of his program. At least, you know, if you wanted what I had, like, we weren't doing the same things. And I've seen that time and time again over the years. Anyway, to jump back, family split up. My mom kind of took off as a, you know, blossoming, flourishing alcoholic. Things got rough for her pretty quickly. In the matter of, like, 5 years, we, you know, ended up getting evicted a bunch of times, breaking back in to the house that we were staying in. I learned how to break back in, not even knowing that what we were doing was, like, not legal. And through a bunch of, you know, alcoholic living and that type of stuff, she, like, lost the car she had, lost the job. Like, just things were just not in good shape. Like, I almost failed the fifth grade due to not being able to get to school, you know, because I didn't know where I was going to be each day. And it was a matter of, like, yeah, I don't know if I was going to make it to the bus stop or get a ride or whatever it was going to be, you know. So that's kind of what I was dealing with. And I knew that had something to do with these people that were around. And, like, they did a decent job of kind of keeping me out of, like, eyeshot of this stuff. But I had an idea of kind of what was going on and being around some of these people. You know, what ended up happening, my dad came and grabbed me, and he had moved. He was on the West Coast out in Vegas, and then he moved back east up to Connecticut and grabbed me for the summer, so I thought. But really, it was like, I'm taking him, and he ain't coming back. And you know, I understand why he did that in that situation. It was pretty unstable, right? So, but I had to leave everything that I knew, even though what was going on wasn't great. It was like, all the family members that I had, cousins and uncles and people, everybody, you know, neighbors, friends, I had to leave all of that. And it just kind of left me feeling a little kind of shaky, you know. As a kid, I felt pretty normal. I think sometimes it can be expressed like, you know, super insecure, super heady. I think a lot of kids are kind of that way. But I just had no solution for that kind of, like, uncomfortable feeling that I had until shortly thereafter, I had moved up there with my dad. I found some kids that were doing some things, you know, drinking and getting high and stuff. And this is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. The drug thing is a part of my story. It is obviously not, it's not why I'm here. You know, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. So drinking was my thing. But honestly, I don't really remember my first drink too well. I remember, like, one of my first few, like, good drunks. And I remember the first time I smoked weed, and you know, it was a very underwhelming situation. No one peer pressured me into anything. I went and sought after this stuff. I had overheard people talking. I was a good ear hustler and listening to people's conversations and trying to figure out how can I fit in and make friends. And we played sports together. I played sports with this guy, and And part of the reason I bring this up, because this is like the first guy I did anything like that with. He's also the last guy I did anything else with, like some years later, which is kind of ironic. And hopefully it continues to be the last time I do anything. I don't even know if I got high or whatever with this guy, but, you know, moved on past that and got into high school. And drinking was like a big thing with like the college, or not the college, the football team, the high school that I went to. And really good team, state championship or state contenders every year. I had no part to do with any of that. I was a bench riding guy that was just kind of like, I was asthmatic, like allergic to everything, like just couldn't catch a break in that field, you know. So I just hung out with the guys that seemed to be doing good and having fun and enjoying school and had friends and chasing girls and getting new sneakers and playing all the cool video games and just anything that, like, it was just like, you know, anything that seemed exciting and like somewhat easy, I was attracted to. And so got into high school, drinking on the weekends when I could with some buddies. People, you know, we'd have, there was tons of, like, I was in the woods, like, I guess kind of similar to, like, out here, no offense, totally love Mother Nature, but, you know, a lot of parties in fields and backyards and stuff like that, and then when it got too cold, we go to basements and things, and what ended up happening with that is, like, I, like, took to it very quickly. Like I said, I can't remember, like, first time I drank, but I remember some of those early times of getting drunk and just, like, how it felt and you know, just feeling cool and having a bottle in my hand and talking to people and laughing. And I do know that I remember just kind of feeling, like, at peace with just everything. Like, whatever it was that I was thinking about, worried about my mom. My dad was kind of he was a Vietnam vet, kind of a hard kind of guy, but loved me to death, absolutely. And, you know, I have an older brother, about 10 years older, nothing like me. He's actually my half-brother, but we're both each other's, like, only half-brother. So we've always just kind of considered each other brothers, but we are nothing alike. Like, he does not have anything of an inkling of what I have or what we have as alcoholics. Like, just a snapshot, like, he got to go to like China to learn Mandarin his senior year of high school, you know. Like, I was sent my diploma in the mail because I got caught drinking my senior year of high school, you know. Wasn't allowed to walk for graduation, hadn't been out of the country by that point, and, you know, only to a couple of states, like, and this guy had been like halfway across the world. So, but he had also kind of found religion essentially early on through his grandmother. And so, you know, I started doing all that. That was kind of going into high school. And by the time winter break came, like, I'm selling drugs. I'm just in it, you know. And I was doing this to get money. Like, at that point, I was too young to actually get a job. I kind of wanted one just so I could kind of have a couple dollars in my pocket so I could do what I wanted. Like, I knew that the little allowance my dad was giving me was not going to be enough to do the things that I saw people doing. I wanted to kind of seem like some sort of big shot. Not like in a bar room, because I was obviously not old enough to be in a bar, but, you know, I wanted to be a big shot amongst the friends that I did have, and I thought that that would kind of gain popularity, and if I became that guy who had, like, a car and girls hanging out with them and, you know, all this stuff, all these outside things, that it wouldn't matter how afraid I really felt on the inside. Because I started to do a lot of things that I didn't really believe in and that terrified me, but I did them because it was what people around me were kind of doing. And those weren't necessarily, they weren't bad people for it. You know, my moral compass was kind of like all over the place. Like, I had been shown good things and raised in a decent manner. Even though things were kind of rocky, there was, you know, certain things that were just like not happening and not tolerated in the household. But I was a corner cutter. Like, I wanted an easy way. I felt like all my life, like, I always had it so hard in certain aspects, which, yes and no, but, you know, more so, you know, things were pretty all right. I knew people who had it much worse than I did. And, but, you know, started selling drugs and really got into that, I guess, as best as you could. Some people say, like, oh, I was, you know, really good at this and that. I was not good at it at all, you know. Heavily supported my own habits with drinking and things like that, as well as you know, I was all about just kind of like showing off. And I just broke every, whatever the rule book of that lifestyle is. I broke all of them. I'm telling people about it and bragging and all this stuff. And when you act like that, you, that catches up to you pretty quickly. And the law became a part of my life and couldn't quite shake them, you know, from then on. And what ended up happening, I got arrested for the first time. Small charge. It might have been like theft or something like that. I don't even remember the exact of it. But got probation, or no, did not get probation. Got community service and went through the whole thing. And you would have thought that I was like John Gotti, like beating some big case, and I was some big time guy who, you know, just got off with just having to do some community service. And really, that was not the case. You know, my dad is the one who bailed me out of that situation by getting me a little lawyer to kind of help me represent myself and told me to go to court looking something like this. And I did those things. But afterwards, I just went right back to the same thing I always done. And even during that time period, like, I didn't, drinking or doing any other stuff that I was doing did not slow down or stop. If anything, it probably picked up. And that was kind of the case for me. Like, I like how the book talks about, you know, we get tight at the exact wrong moments. And it's kind of in context of some other things when things are kind of going good or whatever it may be. But for me, like, I would have, like, you know, a big thing like court coming. And, you know, I'd know that I'm supposed to stop doing these things for X amount of days or weeks beforehand. And I just could not get it together. Like, alcoholism had me and I didn't even know it. You know, I was living with my dad and he worked a job where he would go to work 11, 12, 1 o'clock in the day, right? So that means you're not getting off till 6, 7, 8 o'clock at night. He worked almost an hour away. He was a big bar drinker himself. We didn't have a lot of booze in the house, so there was no, like, liquor cabinet for me to steal out of. But so he wouldn't get home until who knows when, you know, the days of the week that he would work. And so I had free reign to the house to myself. There was very little, you know, we didn't have any family in the area, so it was kind of like just me doing whatever the hell I wanted. And I did exactly that. I had people in his house hanging out, people hanging out in his bedroom and on our back deck and, like, just in all areas of the house doing God knows what in any one of those rooms and just allowing it to happen because people were bringing the things that I wanted, you know. And my drinking started to pick up and I met some – and honestly, for somebody my age, it was surprisingly easy for me to get booze, you know. Reason being, I made friends with some guys that were a little bit older. I had friends whose parents had liquor cabinets that we raided, right? And eventually when I got a little job, I purposely did not, get my check deposited into the bank. I would take the check, go to the local liquor store, or package store, they call it up there, and cash my check at the package store. But on the way to the register in the back corner of the store, I would kind of walk through and slide whatever flat bottle I could in my back pocket. So whatever I could get in my back pocket was my favorite thing to drink that time, you know. And it was often a rum. I was a big rum drinker, drink a lot of rum, drink a lot of vodka, drink whatever was really available. During the school week, I kind of kept it limited to drinking 40 ounces and beer. And then on the weekend, I'll throw some liquor on top of it. And I thought I had some sort of control, you know. I wasn't really looking at it as that, but I just thought that's like a more normal thing to do. And I remember having friends and people that I was acquainted with that would come to school drunk in the morning. And I would look at them like, what's wrong with them? Like, why would you come to school drunk? Like, how stupid is that? You know, meanwhile, I'm like getting high on the bus stop and then waiting until after school to drink. But judging them from afar. And then also telling myself that, like, real alcoholics drink in the morning. Don't know where I got that idea, but alcoholics drink in the morning. I'm not going to be that. What ended up happening, like the turning point. But what happened next was the trouble just kind of kept, like, redoubling over and over. I ended up on probation eventually. And that lasted, you know, I was out there drinking for about 5 years. I was on probation for probably three and a half. I went to a number of outpatient facilities. I went to an inpatient. I was locked up for a week. I was locked up for a day or two. Multiple times these things happened. And I had just lost all control or ability to kind of slow down or stop or anything like that. Like, if anything, I would, like, trade one for another for, like, a small period of time to try to get some heat off my back. And sometimes that would work, and sometimes it wouldn't. And then it kind of dawned on me that if I cannot drink for, you know, a day and go see my probation officer and I'll be just fine, right? But the other thing is I gotta let go. And so I would do that for 4 or 6 weeks at a time, whatever it was at the timetable. I would line it up with what my probation officer had me scheduled for. And it just almost seemed like everything was kind of slowly but surely just closing in on me. Every time I got arrested, something would, you know, more consequences would be thrown my way. And I would try to lie and weasel my way out of it. And people would go out of their way, good-meaning people in the school that I went to. And they would try to, you know, talk to me and see what was going on. And I would try to play the game of, well, you know, as my parents are split up or my dad's not there or he doesn't show up to my baseball game. Like, anything that I could kind of throw out as like a, you know, a red herring of like, you know, this is why I act this way, I would, right? But it got to the point where I just like, I ran out of the tricks to throw out of my bag. And I was kind of left there standing like, all right, like you're just really just a real mess up. And you have no control. And I remember multiple nights in my drinking, especially once I kind of really got into it, where I'm like not showing up, not coming back home for days at a time. And just really doing whatever the heck I wanted, stealing money out of my dad's wallet. And thinking that I'm not doing it in such a, I don't even know what you want to call it, but I would, for instance, he would have a $50 bill and I would have a $20 bill and I would switch them, you know, net gain $30, but I left him $20, you know, like doing stuff like that. And then that graduated into figuring out his bank account, you know, and getting money directly out of there. And he had ended up with a second car at one point. And so I would, you know, knew where the extra keys were, and I'm riding around, no license, doing all the things that I described earlier, and just really putting him and myself and everybody around me kind of at danger. But I had no regard for any of that, you know. Totally about me and what I'm going to get and feeling good. That's ultimately what I wanted. I wanted to feel good, and I found that alcohol and other things that I was doing allowed me to feel good when I did them. And so I tried to do them as much as I could. So, you know, my regimen was getting messed up, you know, before I got on the school bus in the morning, wait a couple periods, found a secluded area around the school, do it again, go back to class, maybe not go back to class. I would go to the ones that I needed to go to, absolutely had to be there. And then the ones that was like kind of big and people are all over the place, I might slide out and be gone for the rest of the day. And then I'd start drinking. And the way my dad's schedule was, it's like a lot of the times, I mean, he kind of knew what I was up to, but he had little means of being able to stop me, cause he had to go to work, you know? So my house was like just that place where everybody went. You know, early on it was like I could, you know, drink, pass out, wake up, clean up, and go to bed and it looks like nothing happened. But like as time goes along, I'm getting sloppier and sloppier. I'm drinking longer. Not getting everybody out the house, having to introduce my dad to these strangers, him freaking out, like, who are these people, him finding contraband and empty bottles and stuff around the house. Just all trust is lost there. And that was definitely like a major thing that I had destroyed in my drinking, was the trust of those who were close to me and even those who just had a care and concern for me. Like, maybe I wasn't super close to them or they weren't family, but they cared enough to try to see how they could help. And I just always turn my back on them. I wouldn't have told you that. I would have been like, oh, I show up for them and I show up for this thing when I'm supposed to. And yeah, I may show up, but I'm showing up halfway there, halfway not, trying to figure out an excuse to get out of it, maybe breaking plans at the last minute. Just of no, I had no real character that I could be proud of, you know, in the way that I acted. And so probation carried on, all those other consequences carried on. I got into about my senior year of high school and, you know, I really had like in my mind, I was like, all right, we're like really going to do something different here. And we're going to stay very low key. We're not going to talk about things. We're just going to kind of keep with just a few people and it'll be just fine. And that lasted about 3 months, you know, and I ended up getting arrested, possession with intent to distribute on like a Saturday, right, at a parking lot. Not in a school zone, but the school was so sick of my stuff. I lived in a small town, so every time I got arrested and your name was in the paper, we had a cop at the local police force in the school every day. So it's like, it was very easy to know, like, what was going on. Teachers were treating me differently, and I would have told you it's because of the color of my skin, or it's because of, you know, they're holding this or that against me, or whatever I could find, you know, anything to divert the attention from how I was actually acting, you know, which was totally irrational and crazy, and I'm yelling at teachers and yelling at the principal and cursing people out, getting into fights, and doing all this stuff out of fear is what I learned as I got into the program and got working the steps. But at the time, I would have just told you, people just aren't treating me right, you know? Like, if they just leave me the hell alone, I would be just fine. And, you know, getting in, you know, having all these things happen and these consequences and stuff that year, and, like, got arrested that time, and it was, like, a big ordeal. Like, drug-sniffing dogs in the car, you know, Saturday afternoon at your local grocery store, everybody in town goes there. My friend's parents are seeing this whole situation. And kind of to put the cherry on top of that was my grandmother was in town at that time visiting because my dad had had a minor surgery, nothing big, and she was there to kind of help take care of him. And so she had to see me in the back seat of that police car, you know, and she's crying like, why? Why'd you do this? What's going on? Like, why are you causing all these, you know? And I'll never forget what that looks like in my mind. Like, I remember that day very well. And that's my... When I read through the book, you know, early in my sobriety, and even still today, when I hear incomprehensible demoralization, I think about times like that. You know, I think about the times where my dad found me at, like, a party where people have passed out, thrown up, stuff all over the place, just not something that, you know, any parent should have to see their child in. And, you know, just all sorts of situations like that, the stealing of the money, the him finding me, you know, bagging up drugs in his house when I think he's gone for the day and he comes back, like all this stuff. And like, so everything's kind of closing in and all this stuff is racing through my mind. And I'm just like, something's got to like change somehow, some way. And but I just couldn't stop, you know. My school allowed me to do like a night school thing to get my diploma. I did so well in that, which was super easy. And I'm not like a studious guy at all, but they made it as simple as possible. They allowed me to go to prom, right? And so this is fast forward 6 months. My court case is still kind of pending. Probation officer's not happy with me. Seeing her like every other week. Drinking has really stepped up because I know I can like manage to like not drink for the, you know, small window before I need to see her. And as I hadn't gotten physically addicted to alcohol. And that's just kind of how my story was. And I didn't have a lot of blackouts or anything like that, but I was very consistent in my drinking. And what happened was I went to prom and found somebody that's very similar to me. And we went and she duct taped I convinced her to duct tape a flask to her leg to bring into the prom, right? Real classy. And I was like, man, this is going to be a good night. Like, I got everything set up for a party afterwards, all this stuff. And I forget, and this is before, you know, I'm not old or anything, but this is before everybody had phones, and especially there was no phones with cameras. So I had to go get the disposable camera out the car and go back out to the car, and the bottle sitting there. And I'm like, well, instead of going through the trouble of getting that duct tape flask, let's just tip up the bottle. And I got caught, you know. Chaperone had gotten there late, saw me in the parking lot, kicked out of prom. We don't want to deal with you. We'll send you a diploma in the mail. And again, I'm just like, how do I just can't seem to go more than a few months without something like that, like me just bringing it all down again, you know? And I somehow stayed out of jail. My probation got extended. I had more community service to do. I had more programs to go to. By this point, I had been to Alcoholics Anonymous as a visitor in all senses. Like, my mother had gotten sober and had a couple of years, and I saw just leaps and bounds of transformation in her life, you know. Saw from the halfway house to her own place, to, you know, a little 20-something-year-old car, to like a 10-year-old car, to, you know, just like little things getting better in her life, job. She was just like the mother I remember before anything had kind of really happened. And she didn't force this thing down my throat, but when I would come to town to visit her, she would take me to meetings, and I loved going to speaker meetings and listen to people tell their stories, like I'm standing here tonight. And because I got to hear, like, all, it almost seemed like a movie. It was like almost like reading a book without reading it or something, you know. And I'm a real, like, I don't want to work hard for things, especially then. And so I had my introduction and had visited because of that, and had visited because this treatment had sent me, and couldn't tell you anything that I had heard in almost any of those meetings other than I remember stories were exciting. But when it was a discussion, I was literally watching the clock. Could not wait to get out. People will come and greet me like you guys greet here, and I really appreciate that. But I was just not, wasn't willing, didn't want to do any of the work. But at this point, I had kind of run out of options of like, what do I do now? And I literally had no idea. I thought like if I could just somehow get into college maybe, which I had done nothing towards anything like that, like knew none of the steps necessary, had taken an SAT prep class, but then took the SAT after a wild night, like one of those like dream nights that you have of partying in a way, maybe not to the max, but it was a crazy night. I'm like hungover on multiple things. I go in and I think the SAT then was like out of 1600, I got like a 740 something, like just terrible. I don't know anybody who's gotten that bad. And I'm not saying I'm dumb, but I was not college material basically. So it was kind of like, all right, I guess I'll just like work and figure it out. And in the meantime, me and my dad's relationship is just totally deteriorated. And we're getting into fist fights now. Like he's upset with me just because I'm like, I sleep till noon. You know, I'm just basically like a vampire. I eat his food, do the bare minimum around to kind of keep things together, and show up to my little job that was seasonal. And then when the season ended, I had no job and had been fired from other places in that little town that we lived in. And just options were pretty limited. And so by kind of the end of that phase, I was essentially homeless. Like my dad kicked me out, let me back in multiple times. This last time I was like, I don't want to come back, because it was always under the guidelines of you can't do any of this stuff. Like, can't be drinking, can't be getting high, none of this stuff. And I felt like he was being hypocritical. Like he drank a lot, and he, you know, no one was on his back. Like, why is this a big deal for me? And I just knew I couldn't do it, is really what it was. I didn't want to admit that to myself, but that's like what it was. Like, I couldn't do it. And so I just stayed out on the streets, you know, slept in basements, and my friends let me lay on their couch, or if I had enough money, I'd, you know, get a hotel room at like a, you know, nice place like a Howard Johnson or something like that. And that's how I was living. And I did that for probably about a month, maybe something like that. And meanwhile, keeping in contact with my mother, and she had offered me an opportunity to move down to D.C., which is where she was staying at the time. And it wasn't even to move. It was to go to a program. Let me retract that statement. It was to go to a program for a period of time to try to get myself together. And she had told me, which is probably one of the greatest lies anyone has told me, that she had talked to my probation officer and it was okay for me to go. And I wasn't going to double check that. I actually had a pending investigation going on for some stuff that me and my knucklehead friends had done. And I mean, I was a knucklehead as well. But we had just taken some stuff. You know, we stole. You know, we stole from somebody. And like the worst kind of stuff, like Natty Ice. Halloween candy, like just a fog machine, like I think VHSs or DVDs, like just stuff that was of no value, and tried to vehemently deny it. And so we're being investigated separately, and the cops are trying to put us against one another and all this stuff. And so I'm just like, I'd love to kind of get away, you know, but it was the idea of going somewhere for an extended period of time scared me. And I was like, let me think about it. I'll call you tomorrow. And this is on a Sunday during football season. And by this time, I had progressed to, like, day drinking. And it's probably, like, around noon. You know, that was about my breaking point. Like, if you drink afternoon or just before noon, like, it's okay. So I'd already started drinking, started doing some other stuff. And what ended up happening, she tells me that either you come now or you don't come, and hung up on me. And I was like, man, all right, that's pretty rough. But for whatever reason, I looked up what Amtrak tickets were available to come to D.C. that night, and there was something about 6 o'clock that night, and I gave a guy the rest of the things that I had and asked him if he could take me to the train station, and got on the train and came down to D.C. And I sobered up on that train ride. It's about 7 hours or so, and I realized, like, man, like, I just left everything that I know yet again, and I was just full of fear, no idea on how I can do or get anything. My mom made it very clear that she didn't want any of that stuff at her house. And, you know, me not having ever lived in like a city, like I was just terrified of trying to go out there and figure it out on my own on how I can get these things or whatever. So I was just dry, just sitting on my hands, just dying. You know, like my head was so loud. Every night I would just like listen to like loud, angry rap till 2-3 in the morning, play video games until I would like pass out, you know, because I just couldn't go to sleep just like naturally going to sleep was like not an option. And I would get up, you know, 12, 1 o'clock the next day and just kind of just wait around and I would kind of roam around town and I would go to my outpatient thing. And when I went there, I was like, everybody here is so much older than me. Like, what, you know, these guys have been on the streets for years, some of them heroin addicts and all this stuff. And, you know, drunks that like literally were around the fire barrel. And like, how do I, you know, that's not like, I don't get that. Like, I'm too young to have had to be at this point. But it also kind of had dawned on me a little bit, like, how did I get to this point, you know? And so this is like small little awakenings here and there that were happening. But I really didn't know if this was for me, you know. I was given one of these, and I was reading it on my own, very confusing. No idea what I was doing. Hadn't really read much throughout high school. Did the bare minimum. Could barely, honestly, I couldn't read that well. I could tell you what the words were, but if you had me reading out loud, terrible, like really bad when I first got sober because it just was so out of practice for me to do anything like that. And so comprehending the big book was like not possible for me at that time. Trying to figure out the sponsor thing, didn't understand what that was, thought that it was like cost money, wasn't really asking questions. My mom explained it to me and I was like, well, can you be my sponsor? You know? And she's like, ah, don't work like that. and thank God, because that would have been just terrible. And imagine doing a fifth step with your mother. Just awful. So I just kept going to these meetings. And what I ended up meeting a guy who became my sponsor and three other guys that night. You know, and three of the four guys, my sponsor and two others, are still sober today. And that was back December 2003. I met these guys. They were just doing some outreach for a sober event for New Year's Eve in that area. And I was like dying, you know, thinking about New Year's Eve. Like, what do I do? Like, I hadn't been sober on New Year's Eve in the last 5 years. Just no clue, no plan. Every night I'm going to these meetings. Or going to my outpatient, or both in the same day, and just kind of lost in this thing, but not sure if it's for me or not. But feeling like I'm glad I'm kind of away from all the trouble and everything that kind of was like constantly in my face. And I know tons of people kind of get sober where they drink at and stuff. And maybe it would have been possible for me, just not my story. And you know. It was very helpful for me to kind of be away a little bit. But I did keep in contact with these people, and it turned out to be kind of a bad move. And my sponsor started bringing me around guys that had and nothing wrong with the meetings I was going to prior to. It was I needed, you know, I was 18. I needed some fellowship outside of the meeting a little more so than maybe some of these other guys. Like, they would occasionally get something to eat and occasionally do something else. But a lot of them, families, kids, worked all week, all this stuff. And but they, you know, they made themselves available as best they could. But when I started meeting people that had been where I've been at the same age and had been sober just a couple of years, like my sponsor had just about just shy of 3 years when I met him. And but this guy had something about him that just was very confident in the way that the program has worked in his life. And he was very I don't want to say deliberate about what was in this book, but he was in a way that was like easy for me to relate to. Like, I was 12 steps exactly how it talks about it in there. Like, he, you know, when the mood was light, he would tell jokes and stories about his past, and that would open me up to talk about mine. And, you know, he would tell me about what got him into the treatment center he spent several years in. And, you know, and then we would talk about that, but then we would talk about something else. We'd talk about sports. We'd talk about, you know, music or whatever it may be. And he just made it feel, he just made me very comfortable and welcomed to Alcoholics Anonymous in a way that I just had been exposed to yet at that point. But I was still very unsure on whether or not it was for me. And I can't tell what that says. Does that say 745? 35. Okay, thank you. 45. Okay, thank you. Sorry, this is recorded, so now it's on there, but it's okay. So I drank several more times, and all it was is that I just was not willing 100%. Like, I was, I would go back to go to court, and ended up getting off probation somehow. I don't even know how that happened. A couple of years early, and people from AA kind of really showed up for me with like letters and things like that, and it was like really nice of them. And I, you know, I felt like all right, like I can go back and try to do this thing. But it was like, then the thought would come, like, well, I haven't drank without any consequences in years. Like, what would that be like? And off to the races again. Like, the same day I got off probation, drunk that night, you know. And then a couple months later, I go back for something else, drunk again. And people have given me the blueprint on what to do when I go out of town. Contacts, where to go, set me up. And I just kind of, like, deflected all that stuff. Just pushed it to the side and was like, you know, I just really want to let guys know how I'm doing. Like, they haven't seen me doing this well in a long time. And, you know, as it's been heard here, I'm sure, by you guys before, you know, their drunk message was a lot stronger than my sober message. And it just took it being me being in the atmosphere. Like, I had no defense at all. And I yet to really start to work the steps at that point. And then the last time, and what I hope continues to be my last time I drank, I had drove down to Florida with some friends, my sponsor and a couple guys, for a young people's convention. Probably about 3,000-4,000 people there. This is IKIPA 2004 in Orlando, Florida. And was there, and everybody's really excited, enthusiastic about sobriety. And meanwhile, I'm kind of being sneaky and making plans with that first guy that I ever gotten high with. He had moved down there a couple hours away from where the conference was and told me we can go out and have some fun that night. And it wasn't supposed to be. He knew. I was like, I'm sober. Like, just can't do anything like that. Like, tried to make that very clear. And original plan fell through. I end up in a club. We talked to some women that we weren't supposed to be talking to, apparently. We get into a fight. I throw a drink in the guy's face. I get kicked out of the club. I'm sitting on the curb. Like, how the hell did this happen again? Again. Like, I'm, like, not even at home. Like, where, you know, I'm in the middle of nowhere. I couldn't even tell you where I was at. And I think I ended up finding out it was something like Bradenton, Florida, or somewhere I was, like, middle of nowhere. And it was just, you know, I had opportunity to drink that night some more, and I didn't. And something had happened as I sat on that curb, and I had the thought, and I remember it pretty well. And it was something along the lines of, you have not tried this thing fully. Like, you haven't tried the steps, you haven't fully committed. And until you fully tried this thing, you can't say it hasn't worked. Because I had no fault, nobody to blame but myself. Like, I didn't feel like A had pushed me or pulled me or anything. They just showed me by their demonstration of how they had been shown. And, you know, these guys picking me up, taking me to dinner, showing me how to set up meetings, cleaning up meetings, had me, you know, I'm with them when they're talking to new people, taking me all, you know, I'm just all over the place. So you guys went above and beyond. And I just wasn't ready until I was ready. And so when I got back home, it took me a few months to get honest about that last time drinking. But people knew, you know, I disappeared from the conference. Like, where the heck did I go? I don't know, you know, who do I know nearby? And so when I finally got honest, my sobriety was kind of able to kind of accelerate, you know. And what I mean by that is I was willing to kind of take the actions that were being outlined in the book, the actions that my sponsor had taken. And, you know, I had done a fourth and a fifth step, and I think I had done that. I did do that while I was still being dishonest about my sobriety date, and that thing just like ate me up, you know. But I was so afraid that there was going to be some sort of like judgment, or people were going to, you know, be like, "What's wrong with you for lying?" And like, meanwhile, I've been in enough meetings at that point. I had been, you know, I was going to 7 to 10 meetings a week, so I had heard, you know, a lot at that point about people lying and all this other stuff. But I just felt like I just can't just yet. You know, I even tried when I came back from that conference from drinking, telling people about another time that I had drank that I was still lying about, and saying, well, since I'm getting honest today, my sobriety date is today. And my sponsor was like, you know, it doesn't work like that. You got to figure out the other day. And I just couldn't do it. You know, like, I was just full of fear, full of lies. Just no idea on how to like live and do this thing at all, you know. And but once I started getting going in the steps, and even though I was dishonest about the sobriety date, I was honest about everything else, and that helped build the relationship that I still have today with my sponsor. And it was that I could tell him pretty much anything, not even pretty much, I can tell him anything, and that there is nothing that he kind of really bats an eye to, you know. There's been things that I've done in my sobriety that I'm just, like, not proud of, put myself and other people in positions that I'm just not proud of, but I can talk to him about these things, and there's, you know, and we work on, you know, what was it that kind of led you to there, and then, you know, what can you do going forward, really, you know. And that's been extremely helpful, and that's how I try to sponsor the guys that I, you know, that I work with. and just try to be, you know, judgment free zone, you know, because had people been super judgmental towards me and the things that I had done when I got here, and I wasn't anything special, like I didn't do, you know, I didn't commit anything too crazy, you know, but I've heard a lot of different things out there, and you know, I know that that's kind of where I can end up as a result of my alcoholism, you know, if it continues to kind of grow and do what it does. And I'll take a few minutes to talk about eighth and ninth step. You know, the other steps, I've worked them. I continue to work them. You know, I've struggled with defects of character. You know, I've found a relationship with God, a God of my understanding, and I ask for his help and thank him for his help every day and every night. And, you know, I have been able to pass along what's been given to me, and it doesn't always seem to stick. Like, I feel like the crop, I should say, of the guys, is how I think about it, is it's a rough patch right now with these guys, and I feel like they're not quite doing what I think they should be doing. But that's, you know, that's not how it works, because I sure wasn't doing what people thought I should be doing either in my early sobriety. But I continue to try to put forth the effort and give my time. You know, that's the most valuable thing between, or I have two very valuable things, my time and my experience, you know. And those are things that people, you know, can't really take from me. And I can kind of choose to give it or not give it, you know. And it's been kind of proven to me that the more of my time and my experience that I give to other people, the closer I feel to other people. And in turn, the closer I feel to a higher power. You know, 'cause there's something that happens when I'm kind of one-on-one with somebody that, like, problems of anything that I have going on just kind of melt away, you know. I had a handful of things going on, like, to, you know, car crash on Christmas, to, you know, girlfriend's grandmother passing away, or fiance's grandmother passing away, planning the engagement, because that just recently happened, you know, roommate leaving, like, just, like, all these different things happening, and I get one-on-one with somebody, and I'm not consumed by those things as much in those moments. And even some of the moments kind of following, because I'm thinking about what can I do for somebody else. And that is not a result of me. That's a result of my willingness to do what's in here and follow what people have shown me. And real quick, what I wanted to say about the eighth and the ninth step is I had, obviously, family members and things like that on there, and places that I worked and stole from and all of that stuff. You know, just had caused some damage in the time that I was out there. And, you know, my dad ended up passing away when I had about 18 months sober. And it was pretty quickly cancer got him. You know, he had cancer of the liver. He was a heavy drinker for many years. I want to say, you know, my opinion, you know, whatever that's worth is, you know, I think his drinking may have had something to do with it. And I found out after he passed away that he had visited these rooms and had I actually have his 12 and 12 at home from when he was in treatment. Many years ago, and he, you know, didn't get the opportunity that I have here, or the opportunity was presented, but he wasn't ready, like I wasn't ready at points, but before he passed away, like, things were kind of rocky in my early sobriety. He didn't understand why I was doing this, because he wasn't seeing any change. Like, I was still kind of, like, I was coming to Alcoholics Anonymous for about, you know, 9 months or so, and nothing was happening, like going back and drinking again, going back and forth and all this stuff. And eventually once I started to kind of catch hold of things and start to really try to take a care and concern for what he was going through, because I think by the time I had about 6 or 9 months sober is when he was diagnosed. You know, I would go up to visit him as much as I could. He was living upstate New York with his family up there. You know, I would call him on a regular basis, and my sponsor would give me direction on things to say to him, like, I love you, when I ended the phone call. And I was like, hey, we don't talk like that. Like, it's an understanding, and I know he does, and he knows I do, but we don't have to say that, you know? And I remember the first couple of times, there was just like no reciprocating of that, you know, no, I love you back. And that felt weird. Like, I wasn't, like, crushed, but I was just like, that's awkward, you know? And I would tell him that, and then he would be like, well, just keep doing it, you know? And I did, and then, like, as time progressed, like, he would say it, and I would say it, and it was just, like, no thing to kind of have that be a part of the ending of the conversation. I had to kind of accelerate my amends process with him, because I wanted to make sure I sat down with him before anything were to happen, you know. And I didn't know when it might happen, but I was able to make face-to-face amends with him probably about 6 months, 9 months before he passed away. And all he really wanted was for me to continue doing what I was doing here, which he didn't know what that was exactly. And I remember he was too sick at one point to come to my 1-year celebration, but He knew something was happening that was working. I think he wished that it could have been something that he had given me, you know, and he tried to give me a number of solutions, for sure. But, you know, I think he had kind of let go of that, or at least that's what I believe. And he also wanted me to go to college. And I was like, okay, I can try to do these things. And I was able to do that. And it took me, you know, 7 years to get a 4-year degree, you know, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, which is totally fine. Like, I don't regret any of that time. And you know, when I graduated that day, I knew that he was there. Like, I felt his presence. Like, I knew that he was proud that I had achieved what he had wanted me to achieve. And the other thing is, I got to keep doing this. Like, I got to keep showing up when people ask me to come out to things like this to share my experience. When somebody wants me to do something that I don't want to do, or want to talk to me about something that I maybe want to try to forget about, or whatever it may be. Like, you know, often comes to mind that, like, what did people do for me, you know? So I keep doing it, you know, because it's worked. Like, I don't know any other way at this point. Like, this is it. This is all I got. Like, if I were to stop doing this, I don't think that, like, I would be okay, and I would kind of, like, just baseline. Like, I'm going to hold it out for a little while. Actually, I can't even tell you what I think I might do, because I have no idea. All bets are off, you know. I've seen people who have had that, you know, same thing back and forth, in and out of the program. We buried a couple people in my home group just last year. And guys who I had seen in and out of the program for, you know, 8-10 years, which is crazy to say because I'm only, you know, 31 years old. Like, I've seen people die of alcoholism, you know, my age. Because this thing is like no joke, you know. Another, it wasn't actually on my amends list. It often sounds like it was, but the state of Connecticut had told me to stay away, you know, after that last court case. And I was like, no problem, you know. So from like 2004 to 7-8 years later, I went back finally, right? And it's because of this retreat that I go to every year. There's this guy who shares his experience and talks about how he had gotten a pardon from the state of California for all the stuff that he had done, and he refers to his heinous atrocities and all this stuff. And I'm like, I didn't have any heinous atrocities. I don't even know what that means, but that sounds bad. But he talked about how he went through the process of basically trying to right the wrongs done with the state, you know. I had run into some troubles with trying to get a job, you know, it was because of my background. And I was so in the fog, I had no idea I even had like a real criminal record. And I had multiple felonies on my record. Didn't even know it until this job told me I lied on my application. I didn't lie, I just didn't know. Too in the fog when it happened. Long story short, basically what happened was I had to, you know, my sponsor told me, hey, why don't you talk to this guy about his experience with getting like a pardon from the state? And I'm like, he did that 30 years ago in California. Like, this is not even the same time or none of that. Like, I don't know, man. But he's like, you should do it. And just kind of like walked away. Like, he has a very direct but like indirect way of kind of telling you what to do in a sarcastic. I can't even describe my sponsor, but he's a great guy. And knows how to kind of push my buttons in the right way to get me to take some action. And so what I did is all I needed was Google, you know, and I Google searched, you know, pardons in the state of Connecticut. Boom, you know, whole website on pardons and expungements. And I found out what's needed. And I'm like, oh, man, but I, like, need a lawyer and I can't afford that. Like, I'm barely getting by right now. And he's like, well, see what you can do. And so I got some paperwork. And it was a lot of paperwork. It was, like, probably half as thick as this book. And I'm going through all this stuff, reading it each night when I come home after meetings, trying to figure out what I need to do, filling out the stuff, getting this, getting that. And it said something about you need like a couple of letters of recommendation, like 2 or 3. So I called my sponsor. I'm like, yeah, this thing says I need 2 or 3 letters. I was like, I'm going to get 5. I was like thinking that I'm like upping my sponsor, like as if like there's some sort of competition or I don't know, like trying to be a goody two shoes. And he's like, you should get 10. And I was like, 10? 10's a lot. He's like, you should get 10. And that was the end of that conversation. And so I got 10, you know. And Luke might have written one of those letters, actually. You know, amongst other people that have been in my sobriety. And that whole process took me probably about 18 months, you know, from start to finish. You know, I went in there and represented myself. Couldn't afford a lawyer. Had somebody that I knew that knew legal stuff that was in law school look over the paperwork, a friend in the program. you know, I went in and they kind of went through everybody's case, and people were very loud and vocal about their, you know, their sobriety and the 12 steps and all these things. And this board was very familiar with, like, the steps and how the program works and sponsorship and home groups. And these guys were, like, stumped. And I was like, can't wait till I get up there. Like, I have all of those. Like, I know how to talk about this stuff. And the line of questions they asked me were nothing like anybody else. I sat in that courtroom for 4.5 hours, 5 hours that day. And my questions were nothing like anybody else who had, you know, similar type of thing going on. And they asked me a lot of questions actually about my father, who had passed away many years beforehand. And they had asked me who got me out of trouble, who bailed me out, who paid for the lawyer, who did this and that. And the answer for all these questions was my dad. And there was something about that situation that just made me feel very like, man, like, he did a lot for me. Like, just really made me grateful for who my father was and what he had done for me and what he was trying to instill in me. And I came out of that courtroom, and they don't give you a decision right then. They don't say anything. They just kind of like, yep, okay, take notes. And you get like a letter like 6 months later. So you just have to kind of sweat it out. And so I go outside, and it was kind of like, I don't want to say like the sky parted and the sun shined, but it kind of did a little bit. And I literally felt like something was with me, you know, again, feeling like my father was right there with me, looking after me. And I knew that despite whatever way that went, I could, one, appeal it, but two, I knew I did the best that I could, like the absolute best I could. Like, it was rare that I put in that much effort to anything. And with the guidance of people here, I was able to kind of do that. And that story happily ended. You know, I got an expungement and a pardon of my record in the state of Connecticut and signed off by the governor and all that stuff. And I keep that in my room, like right next to my diploma. That's how sacred that thing is to me, you know. And if I could put it in my office, I would. But that might raise some red flags. So I don't do that. But I, you know, I wish I could have done a little bit of a better time, and usually I don't have regrets about my talks. I feel like whatever I'm supposed to say, I say, but could have spent a little more time on the bright side of things, because I've been sober now, you know, twice as long and some of the time that I drink. But you know, if you get nothing else, know that Alcoholics Anonymous works, you know. It's just a matter of, like, are you willing to do what's here, you know. And I've really had to do some things that I've had to do a lot of stuff that's not my idea. But those not my ideas have been the best ideas that I've followed yet. And I hope I continue to do that and continue to have my seat here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that, you know, that this ride doesn't end, you know. Because everything good and decent in my life is as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous, or something that stems from something I was taught here in some way. So I'm pretty much out of time, and I'm out of breath and everything else. And thanks for letting me share.